Good evening. Thank you all for being here. I feel I should mention that in February, Dora Lee and I gave a talk about a retreat that we had just encountered. And I had about 20 minutes to talk then. And this will be pretty much the same talk. So I'm more or less counting on you having forgotten what I mentioned on a previous occasion. This talk will be about twice as long, so if you were bored or felt that the other talk was not so helpful, this will be about twice that. So when Jim suggested that a couple of months ago that I give this talk, I thought, well, yeah, that's a good idea. I've been to a couple of retreats in the last 6 months or so and had some experiences that are working in my practice. And I thought, yeah, this would be an opportunity for me to review what had happened and use that as an encouragement to my own practice. And I'd get it all sorted out and present it to you, and it would be nice. It didn't actually work out that way. Mostly, I realized, wow, I'm really confused. That led me to consider what it was that how I was going to formulate this talk, what was really happening. I'd like to review that with you, because it's a big part of, like, my practice. And the first thing I was thinking was, how am I doing with the face-to-face transmission that my teacher, Reb, puts a great deal of store in? Am I showing up here? How am I presenting myself? Am I not so much presenting myself, how am I being? Am I being authentic? And how much is it appropriate for me to say about some experiences I've had? There's some danger of defiling those experiences. And there's also some danger that some less experienced practitioners might be misled into thinking that that's how their practice should be, which would not be correct. And how should I talk about my confusion? These moments of clarity encourage my practice and give me some confidence. But in my day-to-day experiences of delusion, separation, and gaining mind. So how do I practice, reconcile this in my practice and in this talk? How do I remind myself, as I think of it, that not understanding is just an idea? And my teacher has counseled me, don't come to conclusions. I'm not at that point yet. I haven't broken that habit yet. But I would like to point out that any conclusions that I might state are provisional. They may not apply to you, and they may not apply to me at another time. They're just ideas to examine and to test, and I invite your help in testing them. And finally, I notice that anytime I feel I've come to some understanding, I realize that I've been hearing about this for 20 years. It just flew by me. Now that I have a more personal feeling for it, it seems rather banal. That's one of the dangers of expressing experiences. But a great value to that is the realization or the question that arises, what else have I been missing? What else is just going by my ears? And so now I try to listen to Dharma talks and read Dharma literature with more attention and the question in my mind, what could this mean? What could this really mean? Why is this being presented? And try to get through my formulaic understanding of some Dharma that I've heard. So, in trying to get myself on some solid ground for this talk, I thought it would be good to get back to basics, at least in my own understanding. And Reverend Oshita has said it well, I think. Everything changes, and everything is one. From this, it seems to me, it follows that we should all treat each other as ourselves. And we should treat ourselves as if we understood how precious life is. And that in doing anything else, we inescapably will bring suffering to ourselves and to others. This is the mystical insight of all the sages. This is the wisdom teaching of all faiths. This is what science tells us. But our everyday experience is one of separation, confusion, and to some degree alienation. As Clem has brilliantly put it, we all think that we're the center of the universe and everyone else is not. After all, our everyday experience tells us that we are separate. And in a way, we are. So this is the conflicted life into which I'm born. And my life's work, I think, is to somehow realize that these two apparent contradictions themselves express some larger unity. And how do I do this? I've got two ways. I sit with it, and I think about it. These two activities inform each other in some way that, fortunately, I don't need to understand. I want to mention that in the retreat in January, I started keeping a Dharma journal because I realized that Dharma experiences tend to be really evanescent. They're powerful for a time, and then somehow they slip away. And I felt it would be useful to try to see what would happen if I wrote down my experiences and my thoughts, and I have found it very useful. And I recommend that practice to anyone who's interested in examining their own path. Because so often, I've written something down thinking, okay, maybe that's worth mentioning. And then a week or a month later, I say, that's amazing. Wow, that happened. I'm so glad I wrote this down. So, by experiences, I mean some moments of clarity, and sometimes accompanied by visual symbols. And it's perhaps what Suzuki Roshi called letters from just sitting. And to have received such a letter and to remember it is a great encouragement to practice and gives confidence. But it's kind of like having an amazing meal, which changes the way you think about food and maybe changes the way you cook. But the memory of it does not fill your stomach. For that, you might need to wait for another letter. So it's in that, with that understanding, that I offer my comments to you. So I'll begin with the sesshin in August, 5-day sesshin, and it started out pretty well, actually. The first day was great. Reb gave some instruction, and it just sat with me. And I just was ready to fly through the rest of the sesshin. And the second day, I sat down, and it was awful. And it stayed awful. It was just turmoil, emotional upset, mind scattered everywhere, and me feeling just like I was sabotaging myself, I was frustrated, deeply frustrated with the inability of my mind to settle. And as I was stewing in all of this, in my mind's eye, a picture came. And the picture was of a dragon. And the dragon was leaping. It had tremendous vitality. It was leaping and jumping, moving constantly. If any of you are fans of anime, it was much like the dragon in Howl's Moving Castle. Just the most vibrant thing you can imagine. And I realized, and it was my own mind. It was the symbol of my own mind, my object-seeking mind. And what this thrashing, leaping, shining dragon was doing was jumping after objects. Any object it would grab. I'm not sure what it would do with it, but that was its intense purpose. So I used to call this monkey mind, but monkeys aren't like that. This was amazing. It was so amazing that I dropped all of my... I just was in awe of it. My attitude changed completely. I was no longer interested in my own process or my frustration or any of that. I was just amazed at this apparition, this mind. And in that moment of amazement, that shift, the dragon went away, and my consciousness fell into the center of my chest. I may get emotional at times during this talk. Don't worry about it. And in that center was a sense not of self exactly, but of deep presence, of a deep, stable experience of being, just being, of being, period. And in that place I could see these two manifestations of mind, among many others, that dragon mind leaping, seizing objects, creating a world, creating itself and its world. Amazingly, which is my world. And this other sense, this other consciousness, which was stillness and stable and had no relationship to the dragon mind. And I thought, this is just like being in love. And then I fell into a deep contentment. Yesterday I heard the phrase mentioned from Fukun Zazengi. This is not, the meditation I speak of is not, the Zazen I speak of is not learning meditation. It's simply the Dharma gate of repose and bliss. And I hadn't thought of it that way before, but now I'll mention with some, you know, embarrassment almost, humility. That's what it felt like, repose and bliss. And I was in Zazen posture, erect, hands in mudra position, universal mudra, looking down at the ground at 45 degrees, and that's all I wanted to be doing. I just wanted to enjoy being life and being alive. And after time, the bell rang, and I turned around, and the priest was closing the zendo, as it happened, for lunch or whatever, for break. And again, I was just sitting there, looking straight ahead, not looking at right or left, because I had no desire to do that. I just wanted to look at the zendo floor and appreciate that things were happening around me. And then everyone got up and stood in shashu, and I walked in shashu to my where I was to my room, which is the yurt, by the way, for those of you who know Green Gulch. Just in intimate communion with the bark trail that I was walking. And I realized that the postures that we assume in Soto Zen, the sitting posture, the standing posture, the way we do Kinhin, these are not arbitrary. These are manifestations of that, because those, that was how I wanted to stand and sit. Manifestations of that bliss, that sense of just being perfectly okay. Then it went away. Slowly. Without my actually noticing it exactly. Just slipped away. Another phrase that I understood then at the time was self-fulfilling, self-receiving. That's what it felt like. Self-fulfilling, self-receiving. That sense I mentioned of deep, of presence, that's always there. But it can't be called on. It can't be used. I find that if I approach it humbly, without trying to get anything from it, if I listen for it, that's the sense, listening for it somehow, although there's no sound associated with it, it's available. So some years ago, quite a few years ago, I realized that my mind was not, as I previously assumed, like a steel trap. It was more like sort of a rusty tin can with holes, lots of holes. And it wasn't the sort of thing, really, I felt, I realized that I wanted to identify with. And that was very useful to me at the time. It helped me break my addiction to my believing in my thoughts. But it now seems to me that in sort of dismissing the mind in that way, I missed that amazing quality of its, even its egoistic manifestation of its incredible vitality and its ability to create the world. So I'm glad that I have gained respect for my mind again. In a different, somewhat different way, and it reminds me of the phrase that one sees in various koans: "Ordinary mind is the way." And I think "ordinary mind" they mean karmic mind. That's what the dragon was: karmic mind, karmic consciousness. That karmic consciousness itself was my path to what I feel is a deeper understanding of myself. In the January session, I had kind of a similar experience. Again, it was a difficult, for quite a time, it was a difficult sitting for me. I was emotionally fragile. I went in with some emotional conflicts and I felt fragile. But after some time, and it was January 25th, by the way, I mention it just as a, because it's really interesting to me. Oh, January 25th, that was just 3 days before the end of a 3 week session. Mostly I don't have the dates here, but it is useful for me to go back and say, oh, that's when that happened. Anyway, so I had another visualization. This one was, I was just sitting there, you know, minding my own business, being a good student, and in my mind's eye, I saw a space, kind of golden, shining, with ambiguous, indeterminate boundaries. And in this space were the objects of my mind. Nothing much. The tan floor, the wall, you know, the Green Gulch Zendo, maybe somebody coughing. So it's simple. Just a few little objects, and they were in that space. And with the visualization came a strong, you know, understanding, deep understanding, I mean, that my mind is not its objects. My mind is different from the objects that pass through it. The objects are karmically conditioned. They're the appearance of things. This was so clear to me. I wasn't seeing things, just the appearance of things came into my mind. And realizing that the mind is not its object, sort of I felt liberated me from those objects, from the appearance of the objects. Liberated me from thinking that they're real. Liberated me from thinking that what I was seeing, that the objects filling my mind were real. That raises the question, how is the appearance of things different than its reality? Reflecting on this question is an ongoing activity, and for me it encourages the rising of a kind of open-handed, accepting curiosity about things. If they're not real, what are they? What are they? What is this? What's going on, really? And also a deep respect for things, because the appearance is the manifestation of the mysterious, awesome reality. It's what presents to us. It's what's given. So when I say objects only their appearance, I don't mean that in a dismissive way. This is what we have. This appearance of things is our life. It's not real, but it's what we have. This also raised for me the question of the relationship of mind and objects. And it dawned on me that the objectifying activity of the mind is what creates the sense of self, the sense of the separate self. That's ego creates itself. It objectifies reality, and in making objects, it makes a subject. So that the self can't exist except in relationship to objects. There is, from that standpoint, no separate self. Get rid of the objects, the self doesn't exist anymore. This is an interesting observation for me, because I had always thought that no self meant, no independent self meant that, well, the self is the result of many causes and conditions, infinite number of causes and conditions. So, of course, nothing exists on its own. Everything is created by something else. Can't have an object if we don't have space around the object. And that's true enough. But this other perception, I think, is also valuable, that there's a psychological dimension of how self and objects relate to each other, which demonstrates that there really is no difference. You might say even self is objects. Objects are self. Self does not differ from objects. Objects do not differ from self. They mix together, like, so the saying goes, water and milk. So, I have three conclusions from those observations. One, there is a deep sense, not of self, but of something sort of like it, of presence that is subtle and body-based. Two, what I'll call big mind, a non-personal consciousness exists apart from objects which reside in it. And three, small mind, the personal self, as a subject, arises, as I said, only in connection with objects. It can't exist separately. So some of this, some of these experiences, as I've said, were body-based. And in that August session, I started really focusing on my heart, not that center of the chest, that which I spoke of before, that feeling, but the feelings around my heart. And it came to me that there was a tension around my heart, and that tension was one feeling with a tension in my throat. And that tension in my throat was associated with a chronic tension in my jaws that I've had as long as I can remember. It was all one feeling from here to here, and then it became a little discrete in my jaw. And at the time, I equated that with childhood experiences, with closing my heart and closing my throat chakra, my sense of expression, my expressive center. And that may be true. And in fact, later, when I had the realization I mentioned about self and objects being mutually interdependent, I noticed that jaw tension relaxed. Which gave me some confidence and encouragement in exploring body senses further. And that's become an important part of my practice now. Mostly in the head, the abdomen, and the chest. These are subtle feelings, not necessarily associated with any emotion, which are amorphous, unfamiliar and nameless, ungraspable. And my practice now is to rest in them, so to speak, although they're not, stable, and no longer assume they're manifestations of some psychological tension or some other problem. Now I'm just appreciating them as best I can, simply for what they are, for some sensation that my body is generating. And it comes to me that these sensations are, in one way or another, maybe expressions of my unconscious, whatever that is, and that as such, they're kind of communication that I want to listen to. And I realize I really haven't been generous or kind, haven't been practicing the paramitas with my own body. I've come to my body with a, and to such sensations with a gaining mind attitude. What can I learn? What can I get from this that will make me better in some way, that will make life more satisfactory for me? Instead of coming to life as it presents itself to me with humility and appreciation. So this last weekend, Ed Brown was here, and he spoke quite a bit about this body feeling, and specifically spoke about the hara, three fingers below the navel, which I think is pretty much the same as the chakra associated with that part of the body, and also not too long ago, Myo mentioned that, or suggested that we apprehend through the hara, which is a new concept for me. So this is now part of my practice, is trying to apprehend through the body. And in this direct experience also of the ungraspability of my own sense of being in the world, the thought came into my mind, oh, present moment ungraspable, past moment ungraspable, future moment ungraspable. And an elaboration of that arose in my mind. Inside feeling, inside ungraspable, outside ungraspable. And I realized that same ungraspability that was so immediate for me in turning inward is the same ungraspability that I see looking outward. But it's harder to see looking at you sitting here because and all of the world, because I'm so strongly habituated to seeing you all. You all of you. Being as ungraspable, as graspable. That's how I get along. And finally, in relationship to this body, this exploration of my interior existence, and I'm reminded, by the way, of Bodhidharma's advice. Cease all involvement with externals. And with a mind like a wall, enter the way. Another example of something I thought I've known about for 15 years, but now I have a different sense for what ceasing involvement with externals means. Anyway, out of that appreciation, I recall Buddha's earth-touching movement in that moment of crisis, when this story always makes me emotional. In that moment when Mara, realizing that all his traps had failed, challenged Buddha with, what is your authority for becoming liberated? And Buddha, as we all know, touched the ground with his right hand, calling to witness the earth, the ground of being. I don't know, but maybe this exploration of the body is a way that Bodhidharma suggested to us, is a way of touching that ground of existence. Anyway, it does feel right for me. I come now to, with a minute and 22 seconds left.
I don't think you're counting.
Or so. I come to the second half of my talk. which I can summarize as the appreciation of acceptance. It's okay. I didn't have any idea how long any of these things would go. Reb told a story in the Sesshin, the story about from Book of Serenity, case 4. Buddha's walking with his congregation, and he says, this is a good place to build a sanctuary. And the king of the gods, who is among the assembly, or the queen, depending upon his or her mood at the time, plucks a blade of grass and sticks it in the earth and says, the sanctuary is built. My understanding of that, based on Reb's wheeling and dealing with the story. Is that every moment every place is a good place to practice, and since there are so many moments, more moments than places, every moment is a good place to practice. Every moment, and particularly the moments where we don't want to practice, or really more like when the idea of practice doesn't seem available. When moments of frustration, anger, fear, grief, difficult moments, when things are getting away from us, right there, nowhere else, right there in that difficulty, it just takes a moment, go there, and there's sanctuary there, because it's real. There's no longer a split between what your senses, what my senses are telling me, and my idea of the way things should be. Accept the reality, release the idea, and then it's okay. Then I can do whatever I need to do. And it's easier then to see that what I'm feeling is based, associated with a mental fabrication, which is based on appearances which have no essential reality. I don't dismiss them, but it's not where I need to be coming from. And then I can be generous. I can practice the paramita of generosity and patience and ethics and give the feeling to itself. I can release it to itself, and that leaves me free of it. And my understanding of this is that it's being wholehearted. I'm no longer torn between that imaginary reality and the one that my senses are offering me. We have just a few minutes. Poor Raphael. Do you remember Raphael from last week? I was going to pick him up. I was going to meet him somewhere. At the last minute, I learned that he couldn't be there. Could I pick him up somewhere else? But it was too late. I tried to correspond with him, but he didn't answer in time, so he's not here, and I really feel bad, and I have a message from him. I understand. I will not request again, Raphael. So sweet. That's not at all what I meant. I just meant it's too late. I can't pick you up. So he would have been here, and he wanted to be here. Are there any questions? Yes, Karen. Oh, excuse me. I'm sorry. Could you?
When you talk about things not being
I don't understand that. I just realized it. It's just, but rationally, what I see is not a lectern. There are many levels. What I see is not a lectern. It's electromagnetic rays bouncing off what used to be a tree. But I don't see that. I don't see the guy who put these dowels in. I don't see the guy who planed this or sanded it. I don't see the sunshine that made the tree. That's one level of it.
You're seeing an idea?
Yes, I'm seeing an idea. And that idea is my particular idea based on my particular karmic endowment. You know, so first of all, there's the physical reality of, I don't hear sounds, I hear compressed air, you know. I don't see lecterns, I don't see the reality of a lectern. But more deeply, even what my sense, even the tiny part of the electromagnetic spectrum that is registering in my mind through this incredibly complex series of biochemical reactions as a lectern, then that perception is skewed by my karma. Further, my particular karma, we all might see this in the same incorrect way, but we each, you know, see it in a particularly incorrect way.
So we have a concept of what we're seeing.
Yeah. And so that's an idea that you and I are sharing. But sometimes, through some generosity of existence, we see that directly. And then we're, it doesn't mean that I see the lectern any differently, is how I believe, what I believe, but I understand it differently. That takes us to the end of our time. Thank you so much for your attention. I really appreciate it. Please let me know if you have any critiques. Thank you.